The Pittsburgh Pirates are terrible. They've got the worst record in baseball this year. They haven't had a winning season since 1992. And while they're setting a new standard for losing, the team's making money, lots of it. That was revealed in financial documents that leaked out this week. David Berry, a sports economist at Southern Utah University, says it's all because of baseball's revenue-sharing program. That's a kind of sports welfare that's designed to even the playing field.
The idea was that the rich teams, like the New York Yankees, were winning because they had money, and teams like the Pirates were losing because they didn't have money. And so what they did is they said, okay, we're going to take some of the money from the Yankees, we're going to give it to the Pirates, and the Pirates are then going to have more money to be more competitive. And what these documents show is that the Pirates looked at the baseball landscape and essentially said, well, you're giving us about $39, $40 million a year. And so what we're going to do is rather than spend the money on players, we're just going to keep it. So the one avenue is Pirates spend money, they might win. Or they could simply say, look, we're not going to spend the money. We're just going to have a payroll. This year their payroll is around $30 million. They're going to have a low payroll, and we probably won't win. But that's okay because we get the revenue sharing money and we'll make a profit.
So give us an example then of a team that does this well, you know, that gets the revenue sharing money and maybe does well without having to spend a whole lot more.
Well, the Tampa Bay Rays have done pretty well. So they've gotten money and they've done very well. It is the case that in order to win in baseball, it really is ultimately a function of what players you acquire. And you can acquire players a number of different ways. One is you can acquire them on the free agent market. Two, you can trade for players. And three, you can develop them through your farm system. If you're a team like the Yankees, you get to use all three avenues. If you're a team at the lower end of the revenue streams who doesn't make as much money, you're going to rely more on player development. And what the revenue sharing program was designed to do is to give those teams a little more ability to go after trades or go after free agents. It's not going to make them the Yankees.
How does it affect the other teams if a team like the Pirates actually gets better?
This is another reason why, from the perspective of richer teams, why they're giving the money to the Pirates. The other teams are saying, essentially, we would like you to be better. We'd like you to have a better product on the field so that when you come to our park, you're more competitive and we have a better ticket to sell. This is one of the peculiar things about sports. When you think about Target and Walmart, if Target goes out of business, Walmart is really, really happy about that. But in sports, the Yankees have to have the Red Sox. Okay, the Yankee fans may hate the Red Sox, and the Red Sox fans may hate the Yankees. But if you went to those teams and said, if you had the power to exile that team from Major League Baseball so that you never had to see them again, would you do that? The fans might say, you bet I would.
Right.
But the owners would say, that would be stupid. I sell a lot of tickets when that team shows up. I need that rivalry. The rivalry is very important.
Has this release of documents and this whole conversation prompted any rethinking of baseball's revenue-sharing program?
You know, there clearly is an incentive problem here. The Pirates simply don't have much of an incentive to spend the money. And if that's the case, then I think the Yankees and Red Sox are asking, then why are we giving it to you in the first place? Now, it's too early to say what kind of conversation they've had about this. But you would think that going forward, baseball owners are going to be saying, hey, you know, we need to be thinking about how this money is being distributed.
That's David Berry. He's an economist and co-author of the book Stumbling on Wins. He joined us from the studios of KONY in St. George, Utah. David Berry, thank you.
Certainly.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The mainstream movie experience these days with 3D, IMAX, and surround sound can be just a bit too much for children with autism. As the national rate of autism diagnoses climbs, parents and advocates have persuaded some theaters to tone it down. From member station WFCR in Amherst, Karen Brown reports.
One high C, one Coke.
Kelly St. Clair walks into this matinee of Toy Story 3 holding the hand of her 5-year-old boy who has autism.
Mikey, this is the movie!
Mikey's eyes are darting around the fluorescent lit lobby. Like most of the children here, Mikey is on his first trip to a movie theater.
we heard about this, and we think it's a great opportunity to give him a chance to try it out and have some success in a place where people really understand what he's all about.
That includes difficulty communicating, reading social cues, and tolerating sensory stimulation that others take for granted. Anything from birthday parties to the supermarket to the movies.
Between the huge screen and the lights off and the sound so loud, it's very overwhelming, even for typical people.
Renee Hill has a 4-year-old autistic son who loves watching videos, but all her previous efforts to take him to the cinema have ended prematurely.
You'll just constantly notice him look uncomfortable and cover his ears. But if he really gets overwhelmed, then he'll just shut down and have a meltdown and start to cry.
But for this special screening, the house lights are on, the sound is low, and there are no ads or previews. It's called a sensory-friendly movie showing, and as an autism accommodation, it's catching on. This packed event is a first for Cinemark manager Dave Modugno, who takes cues from the audience.
We're going to have the volume at 3.5, which is much lower than it ever normally is. If you need it lower, if you need it a tad higher, just let us know and enjoy the movie. Thank you.
As the movie gets underway, families pace up and down the aisles, eat special dietary snacks from home, and no one tries to shush the overexcited children. The sensory-friendly trend started 2 years ago after a mom in Maryland got kicked out of a movie theater when her autistic daughter became overwhelmed and disruptive at a showing of Hairspray. The mom got in touch with the Autism Society, a national advocacy group, which in turn contacted the AMC theater chain about offering a low-key movie option once a month. AMC spokeswoman Cindy Huffstickler says the company agreed to a trial run in 10 markets.
We were taking a leap of faith. The reason why we did it was because we knew it was the right thing to do. But we have not been let down. It has been wildly successful.
Autism-friendly screenings are now in 124 AMC theaters nationwide and a few dozen other cinemas. Huffstickler says there's enough demand that theaters even make money. Marguerite Colston of the Autism Society says parents see movie-going as a gateway to more mainstream activities.
And it also has that social aspect. When the child with autism goes back to school and their friends without autism are talking about the latest movie, this is the first time, the first step in really socializing with them.
Kelly St. Clair's son Mikey made it through half of Toy Story, which is longer than she expected. And even though he ended up running in front of the screen and yelling, the audience was forgiving and he seemed happy. So the following week, she took him to his first birthday party. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown.
The Caravan Palace Band takes its inspiration from the pre-World War II era. Its music has a strong thread of the 1930s swing running through it, and it produced one of the top records in France last year. But the band didn't find its popularity among nostalgia fans, as Beto Arcos reports. Caravan Palace has found its niche, or is that niche, whatever, in dance clubs.
Caravan Palace was formed when the musicians were recruited to compose the soundtrack for a silent porn movie.
From the 20s or 30s, something illegal, black and white, of course. And we just had to do a score for this. That's how the project began.
That's Caravan Palace guitarist Arnaud Vial. It's an anonymous beginning, considering that last year the group sold over 150,000 copies of its first CD and reached number 11 on the French album chart. At the heart of their popularity is a confluence of gypsy jazz, American swing from the 1930s, and a high-energy electronica beat. After all, Vial points out, back in the 1930s and 40s, people danced to swing music. So combining swing and today's dance music makes perfect sense.
We come back with this old stuff with modern electronic beats. And so people just think, oh, I'm swinging. Just they needed more bass.
From the beginning, the musicians were well aware that they would face all kinds of criticism from traditionalists, especially gypsies or Roma as they're more properly called, who depend on the continued interest in their music to make a living. Violinist and Caravan Palace co-founder Hugo Payan.
We were very afraid of the reaction of gypsies, but they really understood that we weren't here to do the same job as them. We were inspired by their music, by their culture. So they listen our music for what it is, dance music inspired by their own culture.
Caravan Palace's three founding members, violinist Payan, guitarist Vial, and bassist Charles Delaporte, started out as jazz musicians, playing standards in a swing band. But all being in their 20s, they also had side projects with electronica bands. Hugo Payan says modestly, they found a way to respect tradition and still have fun.
We didn't have the talent to do virtuoso music, very technical music. So we asked ourselves to know what we found interesting in that style. And we tried to entertain the people and we found that it was a strong characteristic of our music.
The band's concert in Los Angeles drew an audience of nearly 4,000, many of them dancing. The show's promoter, Leon Hahn, director of programming and grand performances, compares Caravan Palace to another Paris-based band that mixes tango with electronic beats.
Same way the Gotan Project did it. It's that same sort of hybridity that really works, where they're being respectful of the tradition, but bringing it into the modern day sensibility. It's got great energy, and you don't have to understand anything that's being sung. All you have to do is dance.
For its second album, Caravan Palace plans to stay true to the spirit of swing. Guitarist Arnaud Vial says the record will be more focused on the sound of the 1940s, with an emphasis on brass instruments.
Now we like a lot of big band stuff, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, to make something maybe different, more trumpets, trombone, all this stuff.
And that will be the band's next challenge, how to find the bridge between the sound of the big band era and the ever-changing electronic music landscape. For NPR News, Beto Arcos, Los Angeles.
And you can hear songs from Caravan Palace's CD at nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The interstate highway system was designed for long-distance travel. It also helped create suburbs and determine how communities would grow. As part of our series, I-95, The Road Most Traveled, NPR's Greg Allen reports on how the road shaped developments in Florida.
You may have expected the sounds of traffic. Instead, I'm in Florida's Martin County, standing on the bank of the Loxahatchee River. It's just a few miles from I-95, but it's much the same as it was a century ago. And that's a source of pride for Maggie Herchala.
It's a truly wild, beautiful, cypress-lined. Dark brown is the river, golden is the sand.
If you drive north on I-95 from Miami, Martin County is where much of the development suddenly ends. Herchala says that's not just happenstance. She was a county commissioner here for 20 years, and for much of that time fought with developers over a single pressing question, where I-95 should be built. A compromise eventually was reached that preserved the river and existing neighborhoods. But in Florida and up the East Coast, that approach to interstate building was the exception, not the rule. Herchala says Martin County officials did something else unusual. They restricted growth, both residential and commercial development, near the county's I-95 interchanges in order to stop suburban sprawl.
We have had two or three major developments over the years that have been turned down that wanted to be I-95 cities. That kind of thing has happened all up and down the interstates of the world. It generally makes the interstates so they're not much good for interstate travel anymore.
Just north in adjacent St. Lucie County, deliberations about where to build I-95 took a different course. Michael Busha of the Treasure Coast Regional Planning Council says when I-95 was being planned, developers from Port St. Lucie successfully lobbied to build it far to the west through area that had been farmland.
They went to Washington to make sure that I-95 didn't run through the middle of the city, that they wanted an edge road or a ring road, the planners call it, so that there would be access and also a really nice address, a new address for business and housing in the western portions of the city.
Today, 15 years after it was completed, I-95 is no longer on the edge of the city. It runs right through the middle. After it was built, developers asked the city to annex 42 square miles west of the interstate for commercial and residential development. Opponents called it sprawl. Proponents called it growth. Busha says at the time the housing market looked unstoppable, so officials went for it.
Water systems were built, roads were built, and then the boom went bust, the bubble burst, and now there's a bill to be paid.
It's a story that's played out up and down I-95 over the past 50 years from Maine to Florida. A federally funded highway system designed for interstate commerce and national security was embraced by local governments, planners, and developers as a roadmap for growth. In cities like Miami, I-95 was also used as a tool for urban redevelopment, reshaping the city, or at least those parts of it which authorities felt needed reshaping.
How's McCallaloo doing?
This is Marvin Dunn. He's a retired history professor, author of Black Miami in the 20th Century. Callaloo, if you're wondering, is sort of a Caribbean spinach. We're at an organic garden Dunn helped found in the heart of Miami's historic black neighborhood, Overtown. During the 40s and 50s, it was a bustling hub of Miami's black community.
There was a nightclub just on the other side of the street. There were major, major businesses all along this avenue before the interstate came in. We're right across the street from historic Mount Zion Baptist Church, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave many of his speeches here in Miami.
That all came to an end, Dunn says, when city, state, and federal officials began looking for a route for the new federal highway.
They had two choices. They could have brought the interstate straight down the old railroad track, which was vacant property in the industrial section of the community, which would have amounted to very little displacement of the population. The white downtown business establishment didn't want that.
Dunn says at the time, even many black residents agreed that I-95 and urban redevelopment could be good for the community. What residents hadn't expected, though, was how much of the community would be taken for the road. When I-95 was completed in the early 60s, a thriving community of 40,000 had been reduced to one quarter of its size. Something similar happened in Jacksonville, Nashville, Birmingham, Kansas City, all places where black neighborhoods were demolished when expressways came through. Today, with its organic garden, a historic designation, and some new businesses, Overtown is struggling for a comeback. But it will always be literally in the shadow of the interstate. And Dunn says that pains him a little.
As you approach Overtown, the highway rises over the community. So if you didn't really want to see any black people coming into downtown Miami on I-95, you wouldn't. But yes, it's a public amenity that we all use, with little appreciation for the cost involved in getting it.
And that might be something else to think about the next time you're tooling along on I-95 or another of the nation's interstates. Did Americans shape the interstate highway system into what it is today, or did it shape us? Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Our series, I-95, The Road Most Traveled, continues tomorrow, Weekend Edition Sunday, with reports from Maine and Delaware. You got some other stops you shouldn't miss on our website, npr.org/I-95. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Illness may rob us of vitality, but maybe, just maybe, sometimes it can help bring us understanding in improbable disguises. Elizabeth Tova Bailey was struck with a neurological disorder in which she was too weak even to sit up. Illness essentially sentenced her to stay in bed, where she felt life was slipping by unused. A friend brought her a gift of flowers in a small pot in which a wild snail also resided. What once Elizabeth Tova Bailey might have seen as just a nearly motionless mollusk among violets meant to console her becomes instead her companion, almost her surrogate. Elizabeth Tova Bailey, who is an essayist and short story writer, has written a book about how her view of life in a small, slow scale enlarged her view of life. It's called The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, a True Story. And Elizabeth Tova Bailey joins us from her home in Maine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Scott.
And we should explain, Elizabeth Tova Bailey is a pen name, yes?
Yes. Due to my illness, I really have to lead a very, very quiet life. I think it's just a helpful buffer for me in that way. I'm not somebody that ever wanted to write about myself or my illness, and I wouldn't never have done so, but I really wanted to write a sort of a biographical thank you for the snail, and I also wanted to help other patients with my illness.
Could you help us understand your illness a little better?
It's not a very visible illness, but it physically limits you, so it's extraordinarily difficult to live with, and it's very unpredictable.
But, does it have a name? It,
depending on what specialist you go to, you can get a different diagnosis, whether it's dysautonomia or mitochondrial disease or chronic fatigue syndrome.
So a friend brings you this pot of flowers and says there's a snail at the bottom. I thought you might enjoy it. What did you think?
I was surprised and not at all sure why she had picked up a snail and brought it in. I have very down-to-earth friends, and I have spent my adult life living in the country. But even so, I was a little bit perplexed, and it felt like just one more thing that I couldn't deal with and was overwhelming. She, of course, left and drove home, and there I was in bed, unable to get out with this very small animal a foot away from my bed and no understanding of its life or how I would ever get it back to the woods where it came from.
How did you begin to notice the snail's life?
Well, when you're that bedridden and the world around you is quite still, you're too sick to watch television or read, and if something is moving, you start to watch it. I think sometimes of the Emily Dickinson poem about the fly on the windowsill. And the snail was in its shell originally because it had been disrupted from its life and it went into its shell to be safe. And it then later on, a few hours after my friend left, came out of its shell and began to explore. And I just watched it because there was something to watch. And I didn't really become interested. It still felt like a burden and a responsibility. But it was as the next day and a few more days passed, I began to see the pattern in its life. And when you start to observe the patterns of another animal's life, I think you get to know that animal and feel connected.
And the animal ate your flowers, too.
There were some flowers in a vase that had sort of gone by, so I gave it some of those petals, and it began to eat them. And I think when you're that ill and you can do almost nothing for yourself, let alone for anyone else, being able to help this very tiny creature that was hungry was a very amazing thing for me to be able to do. It gave me a feeling of being useful again.
Did you begin to project yourself one way or another inside that shell a bit?
I think my connection to the snail when it was with me that year was more about appreciating its pace in life, it moved at a speed that was actually faster than my own speed. And so it really was peaceful to watch it. It, you know, it moved so smoothly and gently and gracefully. It was like a Tai Chi master. And it was very calming and just helped me deal with the fact that I was at a level that was so low in terms of what I could do.
And now, at some point, you got a little bit better, at least better enough to move home. You've been in a studio apartment.
Yep.
And you thought you ought to release your snail companion back into its natural habitat, but you worried about if it had become domesticated, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, I'm not sure if I. Yeah, I suppose domesticated in that it was used to getting fed. You know, it was safe. But, you know, like any animal, it's incredibly evolved to deal with its own environment. But it was very hard to let it go.
Did the different pace of the snail's life and human life change you in any way?
I don't know. I think that I'd like to say that I continue to move at a snail's pace, but like most humans, I try to do too much still, always. Mm-hmm. It's a constant struggle to live within the boundaries of my illness. And as I note later in the book, there's a point at which I'm doing just a little bit enough better that I don't have as much patience to watch the snail. I think we're naturally geared to live within the speed which our species has evolved to function in. And I think the functioning of humans is evolving to be faster and faster.
Elizabeth Tova Bailey, speaking from Maine. Her new book is The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, A True Story. Thank you so much, Miss Bailey.
Thank you.
A new poll out this week says 20% of Americans, that's 56 million people, have played a game on social networks like Facebook in the last 3 months. Now, most people play for free, but enough of them play with real money for virtual property that these games generated $725 million in revenue last year. Maybe the most popular of these games is called Farmville. We asked a few players for their stories, and these aren't what you usually think of as gamers.
My name is Lee Francine. I am from Fort Mill, South Carolina. My grandmother-in-law, she is 83 years old. She wears thick glasses. She has curly gray hair.
I think she's about 4 years widowed now.
Lives with my mother-in-law. My mother-in-law was recently returning from a trip out of town. As soon as she got home, my grandmother-in-law comes out in the back porch to meet her, and she's very upset. She's distraught, and she says, "Well, my dog is in the pound." And my mother-in-law says, "What do you mean your dog's in the pound?" She thought for a minute she was talking about her Boston Terrier. And she says, "No, my dog on Farmville. My dog's been thrown in the pound. You've got to go to the store and you've got to buy farm dollars for me." The obvious answer was to drive 30 miles to Target, buy the card for $30, and turn around and drive back home that very night so she could get her dog out of the pound.
I got the farmland blues. I got the farmland blues right now.
Hi, my name is Terry Garrido.
I'm Don Wright.
My name is Terry Bogey. I live in Birmingham, Alabama.
Ostrander, Ohio.
Issaquah, Washington. With a couple of my kids and a big dog and a garden, and life is great.
The games make you interact with other
people that I haven't talked to in 35 years.
From all over the country.
200 people that you haven't talked to in 20 plus years. Kind of a trip. My girl is 7 years old. She plays a number of the games that I play. We'll be back to back or next to each other on PCs playing these Farmville games, and she has learned a tremendous amount. There's a commerce aspect, a growing time, and a harvesting, and we don't spend very much time on it, so it's not like we're spending 3 hours in front of a computer. But every couple of days, she says, "Let's check the farm and see what's going on."
girl from Egypt that comes to mind. We've talked about politics, and it's really interesting because in her real life, she's afraid to talk about politics. But I mean, I've reached mutual respect and understandings with her and learned things from her in ways that, you know, I never would have expected from the game.
It's not a tremendous amount of money. I think I'm into them for less than $100 at this point. As time goes on, I'm sure they'll get more of my cash. I don't smoke, so how do people waste their money on cigarettes? But if it's something that brings them pleasure, then, you know, who am I to judge?
I got the farmland blues right now.
Still, you gotta ask, is it odd to spend real money on virtual tomato seeds or a dog in the virtual pound? Or is their value no different than a movie ticket or an entertaining book?
Or a diamond, you know? I mean, most of a diamond's value isn't in the diamond. It's what we think of diamonds, right?
That's Clive Thompson. He's a technology writer for Wired and the New York Times Magazine.
If you spend a lot of time in online games, the awesomeness of your farm, the awesomeness of the rare things you've got is exactly like a diamond, because that's where your friends see it.
We should point out that a vast majority of players do not spend real money to play games like Farmville. Only about 10% do. And I asked Clive Thompson how that works as a business model.
If you've got millions and millions of people playing, you only need to shave off, you know, 10% of those who are going to throw $50 at it, you know, a month, and suddenly you've got $50 million a month coming in.
How is this different from traditional gaming? You know, there's been The Sims around forever, mm-hmm. and these sort of massive online player communities where there have been marketplaces of one kind or another. So what is different? What's changing?
Well, the reason why this has gone so huge is that Facebook has this massive user base of people that are totally avid and are hooked up with all their friends. And this gives them something to do while they're in Facebook that's also social, you know, because you can actually do better by helping out other friends. So they sort of get you on side with making it viral because you sort of strong arm your friends who aren't playing Farmville into playing Farmville. So it's very well designed.
And the idea is to enhance, is it to make yourself better as a player?
Well, to a certain extent, the logic of games like this, these multiplayer games, is they give you something very simple to do, and it can be just sort of a fun way to while away some time when you're at work. You need 15 minutes just to not think about anything. And this gets your mind off everything else. It's the same reason people play Tetris and all those different things. But what makes this different from, you know, just sort of zoning it for 15 minutes with Tetris is that, you know, the more you play, the more experience you accrue, the more gifts you can give to friends. So it starts sort of building on itself. That's what results in the sort of, you know, 3 a.m., oh my goodness, I've been playing Farmville for 7 hours, how did this happen, phenomena that has been around for a long time in virtual world games, where people get very addicted to these very simple things that slowly build up your power or your prestige or your money or whatever, and time really slips away.
And this sort of shadow economy that's building in the gaming world, I mean, it's estimated that it's up to $1.6 billion a year in the U.S. alone. Is this a serious economic model for the future?
Well, you know, a lot of people have wondered about that, ranging from economists to tax authorities. Because, you know, you think about it from the IRS's point of view. If someone is inside a game and they build up tens of thousands or millions of gold pieces, and those gold pieces can be sold to someone else for, you know, a couple thousand dollars, haven't they effectively just done something, like a wagering activity that ought to be taxed, you know? And so the IRS sort of wonders about this stuff. Now, they haven't actually really come down on either side of it very heavily because the stakes aren't yet big enough. But one can imagine a period in the future when enough people are doing things like this that is really worth something in the outside world that, you know, tax authorities start going, you know, we want a piece of this. This is an active discussion amongst economists who follow virtual economies.
That's Clive Thompson, a technology writer for Wired and the New York Times Magazine. He joined us from our NPR bureau in New York City. Clive Thompson, thank you.
No problem.